and care to set the words down, more so because he knew the recipient would notice every mistake. Mara was a scholar, and a pedant too. He detailed exactly what he needed her to do, then read it over half a dozen times to ensure he hadn't missed anything. This letter was too important to be misunderstood. When he was finally satisfied, he folded it up, wrote the address, and called for some wax to fix the letter shut. He put no seal into it. He had no crest or mark he could claim as his own any more. He handed the letter to Morville with a coin. "First and fastest post you can."
"I'll send a boy down to the town," Morville grunted.
Garrick sat back and finished his ale. Gradually he relaxed, tension leaking out of him. The end game had been set in motion then. He was committed, and he found great relief in that. Once he'd fallen to despair. He wouldn't do it twice. If the people of Ossia needed something to get them off their knees, as they had in the days of Jessa Wolfsheart, then he'd give it to them. Hold the course. That was all he had to do now. Hold the course to the bloody end. 56. The day had grown late, and the shadows in the woods were beginning to merge, but a merry fire burned in the camp. Orica's covered cart stood on the edge of the clearing, busy with bright fabrics and trinkets. Her horses were tethered nearby, cropping grass. The others sat around the fire, on blankets or fallen logs or, in Grubb's case, a large flat stone. The dough was suspended over the flames on a metal spit, filling the air with the delicious smell of cooking meat. They ate with their fingers from tin plates, accompanied by boiled potatoes from Orica's supply, wild mushrooms Vika had gathered, and coarse bread. Aaron devoured his food, leaving nothing. He'd been hungry for months before their feast at the Reaver's Rest, and he no longer took meals for granted. Cade chewed in silence across the fire from him, lost in an ecstatic daze. If hunger had been hard on Aaron, it had been worse for Cade, who found eating a form of meditation. Aaron hoped the meal would improve his mood a little. He'd been pouting ever since Aaron and Fenn returned with the kill, pretending there was nothing wrong when there obviously was. Orica wiped her hands and took up her lute. It was a sard instrument, with a long, thick neck and a bewildering array of tuning pegs for its 13 strings. After a few runs up and down the fretboard to stretch her fingers, she strummed a sequence of chords that Aaron had come to recognize. "What is that song?" he asked. "I've heard you play it over and over. I feel I've known it all my life, but I can't place it." Orica gave him one of her languid smiles. "I would be surprised if you could. It is a song of my own devising. One I've been working on all my life, I think. But only now am I beginning to hear it true. Will you play it for us?" "It is far from finished," she said, "but I will play you what I have." She began, and Aaron was struck again by how familiar it sounded, how it recalled other melodies from his childhood without imitating them. He heard old Ossian folk tunes in there, stout, grave battle songs harking from the days of the fall, even a touch of the mourner's elegy, which he'd first heard as a child, sung by a woman as she hung out her washing. It rang with echoes of his ancestors, and hearing it stirred something in Aaron's breast, the same dangerous sense of pride he felt when he thought of the Ember Blade. The others felt it too. Vika straightened, and Ruck raised her head and sat up. Fenn, who was whittling a short way back from the fire, stilled her knife and listened. Harrod, poised stiffly by Orica's side, closed his eyes in mute appreciation. Only Grubb seemed unaffected. He sliced another piece of venison off the dough and set to it noisily, grease dribbling down his tattooed chin. Then Orica began to sing, her husky voice rising into the quiet of the woods, and Aaron felt himself swept away. "The king stood at his window in his castle on the shore,
His family were sleeping, his foes were no more. As he looked o'er the sea, he heard knuckles on the door. 'Twas his seer, white as a ghost. "Sire, please beware, for a storm does draw near, that will tear down your walls and take all you hold dear." But the king laughed and knew he had nothing to fear, and he turned his old eyes to the coast. He said, "I see no clouds, and the waves are not high. Your omens mislead you, your bones fall awry." But the seer said, "Sire, not all storms come from the sky. There are depths to which you cannot see." She let the final chord fade away, and for a few heartbeats her audience sat in silence, expecting another verse. Then Grubb thumped his chest and let out a thunderous belch, loud and sudden enough to startle a nearby fox from hiding. Harrod gave him a glare of furious disapproval, but Grubb didn't notice, occupied as he was with stuffing more venison into the space vacated by the burp.
"There is more," said Orica, "but it is not ready yet."
"I love it," said Cade, "especially the diddly-daddly bit at the start."
Aaron winced on his behalf. Cade's talent for musical critique was almost equal to his skill at flirting.
"The tale feels familiar somehow," he said.
Cade frowned a moment, then clicked his fingers.
"King Cavil the Lionhand."
When Aaron looked at him in puzzlement, he explained.
"Cavil was a king in the Age of Legends. His father usurped the throne from the bastard lord, and Cavil went on to conquer half of Embria, driving out the Urds and almost pushing the Ellaru back into the sea. If he hadn't died, the Urds probably would never have conquered us at all, and the First Empire would have looked a lot different. But he got a bit, full of himself in the end."
"Grubb want to hear what happened,"
thundered the Skull, who was a lot more interested in Cade's story than Orica's song. "His seer dreamed an army of the dead marching from the sea, made up of all the Urds he'd slaughtered, and he warned the king to stay away from his castle on the coast," said Cade. "But Cavil did the opposite and went there straight away. He wanted to show everyone that he wasn't afraid of ghosts, that the Lion Hand was too mighty to pay heed to omens. Many of his followers went with him in support, the best of his army, his right-hand men and women. Not long after, the omens proved true. A great wave came from the sea and washed the castle away, and in the struggle for the throne that followed, the Urds invaded and conquered us."
Grubb bellowed with laughter, spraying flecks of meat.
"Ha! Stupid king not listen to omens. No wonder Urds squashed you."
"Is that what it's about?"
Aaron asked Orica.
"Perhaps," said Orica slyly. "And perhaps not. It will be, a lament for our land, a song for what was lost and what will be again."
Aaron opened his mouth to speak, decided against it, and was grateful when Cade said what he'd been thinking.
"But you're a sard," Cade said. "I thought you know."
He coloured and fell silent.
"Yes, I am a sard," she said. "One of the landless, the chosen folk, forever exiles. But I am Ossian too. I grew up in this land, ate the fruits of its toil, danced under the same skies as you. My people keep no histories, but there are more of us here than anywhere else, and that must mean something. We are all children of the wolf."
"Not Grubb. Grubb has bear blood like all his people. Urds never conquered Scarlands."
"Small wonder," said Cade.
He was eager to take out his pique on someone, and Grubb was a safe target. "Frozen wastes, howling winds, and beasts with teeth as long as your arm? Who'd want it?"
"Grubb does. Grubb will go back one day when his body is covered in glorious deeds."
"No one's stopping you," said Cade,
glancing at Fenn to see if she approved of his retort. But she was back to whittling and wasn't listening. Grubb shook his head.
"Not yet. Grubb has much to do still. Escaping camp not enough. Outwitting dread knights not enough. Even when Grubb defeated Beast of Skavengard, it not enough."
"Hang on, you never defeated the Beast of—"
"Grubb must do deeds so great his people stand in awe," he cried, thrusting one stubby finger into the air. "Only then can he return in triumph."
He picked up the meat on his plate and muttered bitterly, Grubb show them.
Aaron wasn't sure if Grubb knew he'd spoken that thought aloud. He changed the subject before Cade could pounce.
Harrod, back at the inn, you said you'd visited several towns, and the Sards had been moved on from all of them.
That's so, said Harrod, but didn't elaborate.
That is why we came back to Ossia, said Orica, her mouth in a grim line. I am searching for my family.
What happened? Aaron asked.
She gave him that look again, appraising him, judging whether he could be trusted. Though she always seemed relaxed, she was permanently on her guard. Aaron was beginning to see why the Sards had a reputation for secrecy.
There were rumours in Harrow, she said. Sard caravans disappearing. My people quietly moved out of settlements along the coast. We made for my hometown, but we were too late. The Sards had gone, and no one knew where. It was the same in other towns. Asking questions was dangerous. Twice I would have been arrested if not for Harrod. She laid a hand on his forearm in gratitude. It was no more than my duty, he said solemnly, but Aaron saw a tiny flare of triumph in that impassive face.
Morganholm has the largest concentration of Sards in Ossia, Orica said. Not all of us wander. Some choose to live in cities, though it is not a life I would choose, penned like cattle as they are. The Crodans have been moving my people east, so it is likely they are heading to the capital. That is why we must go there too.
But why are the Crodans taking them there? Cade asked.
That is the question, said Orica darkly. I believe they want to keep us all in one place, the better to control us. We have always been free, answering to no masters, and that unsettles them. Maybe they want to stop our wandering for good. We shall see.
Aaron felt a chill. It was hard not to see the parallels. The Crodans had confined his people, too, with permits and passes. Would the Ossians be moved on one day, to make space for more Crodans?
He rubbed the mark on his wrist with his thumb, as had become his habit. His promise to Ethan had been fulfilled, at least to his mind, but the mark remained. Would it fade in time? He wasn't sure he wanted it to now. Standing up for Orica had been one of the proudest moments of his life.
You made another promise too, he reminded himself. A promise to a pirate to complete one task for him, without condition, no matter how abhorrent he might find it. He wondered if Rafa would ever claim that debt, and what its nature would be. He doubted he would be quite so proud to fulfil it.
"And how did a noble from Harrow become involved in all of this?" asked Vika from across the fire. She was scratching Ruck's neck. The wolfhound closed her eyes and flexed her claws in rapture.
Harrod stiffened at the question. Aaron suspected that the druidess discomfited him, with her painted face and unwashed hair, her motley of trinkets and hides. She wasn't like the women of Harrow, who were said to be beautiful and cold, their behaviour and dress dictated by strict codes of etiquette.
"I was compelled," he said at length.
Orica favoured him with a smile.
"He followed my song," she said fondly. "I played at his father's house, and afterwards he swore himself to my service and told me he would ever after be my guardian. He is my knight and my dear, dear friend."
Harrod looked like he was about to choke with embarrassment, or joy, or both. Aaron couldn't help marvelling that two people with such opposite personalities had come to travel together.
"Baldhead followed the song?" Grubb spluttered. He cackled and rolled his eyes.
"I wouldn't expect you to understand," Harrod sniffed. "The height of skull musical accomplishment is knocking a bone against your ancestors' skulls."
"Ha! Grubb think you need to pull that bone out of your arse. Hey, Grubb got the song. Listen."
He began to blare tunelessly.
"Once there was a man with no chin. He had a stupid haircut. He heard song and went, da, da, da. Ball had better go that way."
The skull chuckled at his own wit, ignoring the appalled stares of his companions, and clambered to his feet.
"Ah, Grubb done here. Grub going to take enormous brown dump in woods. You should come, Tonsils. They tell tales of this one for centuries.
Tonsils?
Harrod squeaked in horrified disbelief.
That is a kind offer, said Orica to Grub, unfazed. But if it is, as you say, I would likely not survive being close enough to witness it.
Your loss, Grub said with a shrug.
He waddled away from the fire, leaving Harrod wobbling like a kettle on the boil with the effort of suppressing his indignance. Red splotches crept up his neck, and one eye twitched furiously.
Sorry about him, said Aaron. He takes a bit of getting used to.
Think I'll go for a walk too, stretch my legs, said Cade.
He watched Fenn, hopefully, in case she wanted to go with him, but she showed no interest. Crestfallen, he threw a sullen glance Aaron's way and headed off into the gloom beyond the clearing. Harrod made his excuses and retreated to the covered wagon, where he could nurse his battered pride in private. Orica set to work on her song, trying new variations, stopping and starting again. Every so often she put her lute aside and scribbled some marks on a roll of parchment. Aaron knew it was musical notation, but the signs were a mystery to him. He'd seen Croden sheet music on Nanny Alsa's harpsichord, but he'd never been interested in learning, and his father thought music a waste of time. He roused himself, walked round the fire, and settled next to Ruck and Vika. Ruck licked his hand, and he stroked her back absently.
"Did you really see Garrick in a vision?" he asked.
It was a question he'd wanted to ask since the Reaver's Rest. He was reluctant to engage her in talk of the aspects. They didn't see eye to eye on matters of faith. But he couldn't bear wondering any longer. She'd been staring into the fire, lost in thought. She had the habit of going blank now and then. But she stirred at his words.
"I saw a bright warrior, though I could not see their face," she said. "They carried a blade that shone like the sun, and I knew them for a champion who would stand against the evil that is coming."
"The Crodans?"
"The Crodans are not evil, Aaron. They just see the world differently from us. I speak of forces more dreadful than any empire Embria has ever known. You have glimpsed them yourself in Skavengard."
Aaron felt icy fingers creep up his back.
"And you think this champion is Garrick?"
"The stars were right on the day I met him. He faced the beast of Skavengard and overcame it. Now I learn he seeks the Ember Blade, a beacon of hope if ever there was one. I have had many visions, walked the Shadowlands 100 times, and rarely have the signs been so clear."
Aaron frowned, frustrated. The idea that Garrick was chosen by the gods didn't sit easily with him.
"I know little of visions, but if you didn't see his face..."
"I know it is hard for you," Vika said. "You do not know whether to hate or admire him. But a person can be many things. There is good in the worst of us and bad in the best. Garrick has treated you despicably, and he is your father's sworn enemy. Yet he may be the man we need to lead us against what is to come."
"He's no champion," Aaron said angrily.
"Are you sure?
Are you?"
Vika tilted her head in acknowledgement of his point. Ruck snuffed and got up to pad away from the fire. Aaron picked at the crusted dirt on the toe of his boot.
"The world's changed," Aaron said. "Seems only yesterday I was certain of everything. Now it feels like there's nothing I can trust. Only Cade, and even he..."
He faltered, unsure whether to go on. But there was something about Vika that comforted him, a kindness that made him want to confide.
"If I left now, I'm not sure he'd come with me."
Vika's eyes went to Fenn.
I've seen how he looks at her. And how you do."
Aaron didn't bother to deny it. He didn't know what he felt for Fenn, but after today he was sure he felt something.
"May I offer you counsel?" Vika said.
"Nine, I'd welcome some."
"Have patience," she said. "Answers will come in their own time, and when they do, you may wish you'd never asked. The young are always in a rush to know everything,
but knowledge only brings more questions. Forget the destination, Aaron. Enjoy the journey. You are free now in a way you have never been, and the choices you make now will determine who you are to become. It did little to satisfy him, but he sensed wisdom in her words. He wished he were strong enough to beat the truth from Garrick, or brave enough to hold a knife to his neck, but they were fantasies born of adolescent anger. If he wanted Garrick to give up his secrets, he'd have to be cleverer than that, and wait till the moment was right. One way or another, he'd learn the truth about Garrick and his father, and only then, when all the cards were on the table, would he decide the matter of vengeance. 57. Keel pushed open the door to his son's bedroom, as if he were afraid of what might be on the other side. When he poked his head around, he found Tad sitting up against the headboard, gazing back at him, like he'd been waiting there all morning. Maybe he had. His patience and stillness were almost eerie at times. At other times he was anything but patient and still.
"I thought you might be asleep," Keel said awkwardly.
The grim daylight leached all comfort from the room. Tad's sickness hung in the air like a spectre. Tad just kept on staring. Keel cleared his throat, pushed the door open, and entered. Vika came in behind him, Ruck loping at her heels. Tad stiffened at the sight of the druidess, bolt upright against the headboard, eyes wide in alarm.
"Peace, peace," Keel said, holding out his hands. "She's a friend."
Tad looked from his father to Vika and back again, betrayal in his eyes, as if Keel had tricked him by bringing her here. Suddenly he was a cornered animal, hair wild with sleep, skinny limbs tensed as if to flee.
"He doesn't like strangers," Keel told Vika.
There was an apology in his voice and a tinge of embarrassment, the vague shame he'd carried ever since he realized his son would never be the strapping young man he'd dreamed of. No matter how much Mariella said otherwise, his son's strangeness reflected on him. Tad's nature, his weak body, and now his illness, all felt like Keel's failing, his fault.
"Hello, Tad," Vika said gently. "I suppose I must look quite unusual to you. I expect you're wondering why my face is painted this way. It's because I'm a druidess. Do you know what that is?"
Tad was breathing rapidly now. This was how it started, panic building on panic until he became hysterical and shrieked and thrashed. When it was particularly bad, his eyes would roll back in his head and he'd shake and judder and foam at the mouth. Keel felt panic rising in his own breast. Why hadn't he thought to ask Vika to wash the paint off? Why wasn't Mariella here to handle this?
"Tad, Tad, I'm here. All's well, I'm here," he cried.
But his voice was anything but calm, and it only made things worse.
"Druids help people, Tad," said Vika, as if gentling an animal. "I've come to help you get better. Would you like that? I'm Vika, and this is Ruck."
Tad's gaze fixed on the wolfhound, and he held his breath. In that fragile balance, Keel saw curiosity warring with fear in his son's eyes.
"Let him pet the dog," Keel said.
Without word or sign from Vika, Ruck padded over and laid her head in Tad's lap. Uncanny how it knew what to do. Sometimes it was as if the dog could understand them. Tad, his attention captured by Ruck, put out a tentative hand, drew it back, reached out again. Finally, he plucked up the courage to run a hand down her neck. Keel gave Vika a relieved glance as Tad's breathing returned to normal and a faint smile touched the corners of his mouth.
"Talk to him. Keep him calm," said Vika.
She drew a file from her cloak, unstoppered it, and touched it to her lips.
"Think of something nice," she advised, and took a sip.
Keel struggled to find a suitable topic. Mariella was always better at that kind of thing, but she was in the kitchen with Fluke, wouldn't have any part of this. They'd rowed bitterly about it, but nothing would change her mind.
You think you can turn up out of the blue and fix this, Keel? Another quack herbalist peddling wishful-thinking remedies? He needs real treatment, not more Ossian tinctures and potions. I'm done with looking for miracles.
Well, damn her scorn. He had faith in Vika, even if Mariella didn't. He would fix this. Somehow he would. Think of something nice. It came to him at last. He sat on the bed and held Tad's hand.
You remember when I took you to the fair? The painted men, the mummers in their makeup and masks. You liked them, didn't you?
Tad dragged his gaze away from Ruck, looked at Vika, then back to Ruck, a safer place to leave them.
That's right, said Keel. She's like the painted men. You'll like her. You like her dog, don't you?
Tad nodded. What else did you see at the fair? Vika asked, moving slowly closer.
When Tad didn't answer, Keel answered for him. That was some day we had, wasn't it? I remember how the sun sparkled on the cut as we set out westwards in my boat. There must have been 100 craft on the water, barges, flying pennants, and little rowing boats, all of them heading to Marisport for the fair.
I like the boats, Tad said quietly.
Then he began to cough, his thin body racked with spasms, shoulders bumping against the headboard. Keel thumped him on the back. It was all he could think to do. Vika had slipped up to the bedside now and was watching Tad owlishly, pupils huge amid the black and white smears on her face. Keel was reminded suddenly of Skavengard, of how her eyes had looked when the beast was in her, and terror ambushed him.
The teeth, the mouths, it'll never stop devouring me forever.
I'm going to put my hand on your back, Tad, Vika warned. It will help me tell what is wrong with you.
Tad was too busy coughing to protest, and Vika didn't give him time to. She slid her hand down the neck of his shift, then drew it out and put it on his chest.
Stop trying to suck in your breath, she told him firmly. Breathe out for as long as you can.
To Keel's surprise, Tad did as she said. The coughing petered out immediately.
Now don't pull the air in. Your lungs will fill on their own. Let them.
Tad's chest rose again. He let out another sigh. No coughing.
There, said Vika, satisfied. Well done. Now, about this fair.
Keel stared at her, amazed by her effortless competence. Then he remembered what he was supposed to be doing and took up the story again.
Ah, yes. You remember all the things we saw, eh, Tad? Nine, they didn't sell us short. There were magicians from Caragua who made a bear disappear, and red men from Helica who performed a spear dance, and three acrobats from Kedah with wooden masks and clothes of leaf and bark. While they were tumbling, they told us how they do everything in threes in their homeland. They rule in threes, fight in threes, they even get married in threes. You laughed at them and clapped like you would never stop.
As he spoke, Vika moved her hands over Tad's body, now holding his wrist, now pushing her fingers under his jaw. He submitted to it all, watching her with nervous trust, one hand still mechanically scratching Ruck's neck. Keel wasn't sure if Tad was listening to him, but he didn't want to stop. The memories were as much for him as his son.
There were dog warriors from Zotha, you remember? Men with dark skin who scarred their faces, and such fierce dogs. You'd never seen dogs so big. They bond with their dogs as puppies, and they can live 30 years or more, and when the dog dies in battle or of old age, they retire as warriors.
It sounds like you had a wonderful time together, Vika said.
She bent over and put her ear to Tad's chest.
Now, pull in a breath, big as you can, and hold it. Good.
It had been wonderful. A rare and perfect day, without tantrum or distress. Tad had just turned 5, and Keel would leave Rackham Bay soon afterwards. But on that day, there was no thought of it in his mind. It was only later that he realized the sights he saw at the fair had inspired him, set him dreaming of places far away from this small, small-minded town. As soon as Vika let him release his breath, Tad began to babble excitedly.
There were Zulan chimericists, too. They showed us scaly monkeys, and a fish that had legs, and a concoction that made rusty armour shiny just by dipping it in.
No,
Vika said in mock surprise. "We saw it, didn't we, Da?"
His face was alight, his eyes dancing, and a true smile on his lips. At last he was connecting with them. Kiel's heart hurt for the love of him. If only it could always have been like this.
"We did," he said, patting his son's hand. "We did. And you'll see such wonders again one day. By Johan Hallen, all the aspects, I promise you."
"Really?"
Tad was agape.
"You mean it?"
"I promise," Kiel said again.
Vika gave him a look and said nothing.
Vika's visit exhausted Tad, and he fell asleep again soon after. Ruck led the way out onto the narrow wooden landing between the upstairs bedrooms, and Vika closed the door behind them. No sooner had the latch dropped shut than Kiel's face crumpled, and he wept.
"It's not fair," he whispered through his tears. "Damn it to the depths, it's not right. What kind of gods would allow this?"
Vika embraced him and said nothing, for which he was grateful. He had to fight to keep his sobs quiet enough that his wife and brother wouldn't hear them downstairs. When he got himself under control again, he felt a little better. He'd drained off the bare minimum of his grief, but it still lurked just below the surface. He needed to be alone, where no one could see him, and he could let himself go without shame. But being alone now seemed like the worst thing in the world.
"Dry your eyes," Vika told him, not without kindness. "Your wife needs your strength now. She has been bearing this burden for a long time."
They spoke a little further on what might be done for Tad, and then went downstairs. Mariella and Fluke were at the table in the kitchen, drinking nettle tea. They looked up as Kiel and Vika entered, their faces closed and suspicious. Kiel had the feeling they'd stopped talking just a moment ago.
"He's asleep again," said Kiel.
"Good," said Mariella.
Vika took the temperature in the room.
"I'll see you back at the camp," she told Kiel. "Farewell to you all."
Mariella watched her go with evident resentment on her face. Fluke did the same. He supported Mariella, as he always did. Kiel seated himself at the table, feeling more like an intruder than ever.
"Well?"
Mariella asked.
"I thought you didn't care."
"Just tell me what she said."
Sulky, churlish, obtuse. They were not like this with anyone else, only each other. If they were supposed to be in love, why did they act like enemies?
"She can make him a potion that will ease the coughing and stop the grit getting any worse. He could live a long time that way. But a druid or druidess will have to prepare it once a month, and it isn't a cure. He needs long-term care to get better."
"So, it's no solution at all, then?"
"It's something," Kiel snapped.
"It's nothing," she cried. "More false promises, more false hope.
I told you she's a druidess, not some washed-up herbalist. I've seen her do things. She can help him."
Mariella's mouth screwed up in disbelief. She didn't want to believe that, didn't want to give any ground at all to hope even a little, in case all her defences should collapse.
"And what would it give him? Another month confined in bed? Another year?"
"Isn't that worth it? Isn't even another day worth it?"
"Maybe it is. But what's that to you if you're not here to see it? If you have such faith in her remedies, stay and administer them yourself."
"God spit, Mariella. It's our child's life we're talking about. One of us has to earn money, and I won't get it fumbling with cows on a farm."
"You'll never come back," she screamed, surging to her feet. "Don't you think I know what all this is about? You don't want me, and you don't want us."
She swept her mug of nettle tea to the floor, where it smashed into steaming shards. Her voice became low and hard.
"If you walk away, you're my husband no longer," she said. "I swear it, Kiel. You'll find no welcome here again."
Kiel stared at her, shocked. Before he could say anything else, she stormed out of the cottage. He heard her stamping up the path, sobbing with rage. He stood to follow, but Fluke grabbed his arm. Kiel almost punched him for that,
but Fluke's steady gaze took the heat out of him.
"You'll do no good when she's that upset," Fluke said. "Why don't you and I take a walk up to the farm? We ought to talk."
Keel shook him off angrily. He nearly went after her anyway, but sense triumphed. Fluke was right. Better to let her cool. Better to let himself cool. She'd never made a threat like that before. Never. "All right, then," he said. "Let's talk." 58. "You don't know what it was like," said Keel, as they walked across the damp fields. "The first 3 years he just screamed. Nothing helped. Screamed till he was exhausted enough to sleep a few hours, and we could too." The hillside was divided by fences, ditches and hedgerows. Shaggy sheep cropped grass beneath a grey sky. Distant thunderheads were piling up on the horizon. "Just before his 4th birthday, he went quiet." Keel snapped his fingers. "Like that, overnight. That was worse. 9, at least we knew what we had before. Mariella didn't trust him anymore. She talked about changelings, and I think she meant it too for a time. We'd try anything to get a response out of him, a good response, you know. A smile, a laugh, the things we tried." He felt a drop of rain on his cheek, tipped his face up to meet it. No more fell. It was only a promise of what was to come. "I hated this town long before he was born. Afterwards, the only peace I got was out on the boats. More than once, I took a launch with naught but a harpoon against a breacher that should have swatted me flat. And when that whale was bubbling in the tripods, and my crewmates were calling me a fool and a hero, I'd be sorry. I wanted that whale to kill me, not the other way round. But somehow I could never quite let it happen." He spat into the grass. Fluke offered no comment. "Setting foot on shore again, it was like the world closing in on me, like a cold iron mask fixed around my skull. I'd go to the bellied sail and drink till word reached Mariella I was back, and she'd send you to drag me home." "I remember," said Fluke. "Da always used to say he never felt alive unless he was out in the tempest with a harpoon in his hand. Used to hate him for that, for telling us he'd rather be elsewhere, saying it to his own sons."
"Never thought of it like that," said Keel.
"Well, you always were his boy." They turned onto a muddy track that ran along the edge of a bramble-choked ditch. A horseman was just cresting the rise at the top of the hill, coming their way at a canter.
"Heard about Salt Fork," said Fluke. "Any of you in that?"
Keel didn't reply.
"Iron Hand executed a lot of people afterwards."
"Gutless turncoats should have stood and fought then," Keel said bitterly. It sounded like something Garrick would have said.
Fluke grunted, somehow conveying his silent judgment as clearly as if he'd accused his brother aloud. He was a master of leaving things unsaid. At least Mariella yelled at him so he could yell back. Fluke's method was slow poison.
"You ought to be careful," Fluke advised. "Word's already out that Lane's back, so you can be sure Jadrell's already heard. Everyone knows you two come as a pair. And there's rumours about what you get up to out there. Some say you want to join the Greycloaks. Well, those who don't say the other thing, anyway."
Keel didn't rise to the implication. He knew well what the other thing was. Typical bitter bracker thinking, when two men couldn't share a close friendship without raising eyebrows. He loathed this town, the mean-mindedness of its people, the walls they built around themselves. He pitied his brother, and he suspected Fluke knew it. It was one of the many reasons they didn't get on.
"Rumour's not worth a shark's piss in this place," said Keel. "I'm just one of 100 whalers who left town one day and is back for a visit. Jadrell's hardly going to hunt me down unless he gets the say-so from his Crodan masters, and whatever I did or didn't do out there, my name's not on any of it."
"I suppose it matters naught in the end," said Fluke. "You'll be gone again before long."
"Who said I'm going anywhere?"
Fluke smirked humorlessly. Keel watched the rider coming closer. He was dressed Croden style, but it was no soldier's outfit, nor the uniform of an official. Keel's hand hung a little closer to the sword at his hip, just in case. It was only a matter of time before they stopped Ossians carrying weapons outside the town boundaries as well as within, and if a few more locals got killed by bears and wolves and bandits, then so be it. But that wasn't the law yet.
"You know him?" he asked Fluke.
"My neighbour Endrick. He took over the farm from Starren."
"What happened to Starren?"
"Turned out he didn't legally own the land. Some mistake in the paperwork half a century back."
"And Lord Jadrell righted that injustice?"
"Course he did. Been righting all manner of injustices lately."
"Hail to the Emperor,"
said Endrick as he neared, arm across his chest in salute. He was a robust and vigorous-looking man, whose fine features were not best served by an unnaturally rectangular moustache and a rigid military haircut.
"Hail to the Emperor,"
Fluke replied. Keel saluted after a suitably defiant interval.
"Who is your companion?"
Endrick asked Fluke.
"My brother Keel. Keel, this is Endrick."
Keel nodded with the sullen chill of a bitterbracker.
"Now I see the resemblance," said Endrick. "Family is so important. The very foundation of the Empire, as Thomas says in the Acts. Your brother is staying with you, I take it?"
"He has lodgings elsewhere. I'm just showing him my farm." Endrick's smile didn't reach his eyes.
"Excellent, excellent," he said.
Then, when it became clear he'd get no more conversation from them, he straightened in his saddle.
"Well, I mustn't keep you."
He shook the reins and his horse walked on. Keel waited till he was out of earshot.
"Friend of yours?"
"One of Jadrell's informers. The farm was his reward for it. If Jadrell didn't know where you were before, he will now."
"You could have told him I was someone else. He didn't know my face."
Fluke snorted. "And when he learns I lied? I'm not keen to attract any more suspicion than you've already brought me. I'd find my farm next on Jadrell's list of injustices."
He set off again and Keel walked with him. Presently they rounded a hedgerow and saw a farm down the hill, a scattering of outbuildings surrounding a low stone house, with a handful of animals out to pasture nearby. Fluke came to a halt, and they gazed upon the deep green land of their birth, the swooping slopes, the dramatic cloud-racked skies. Keel saw only mud, thorns and gloom.
"Mariella says you'd have me work with you," Keel said.
"The offer's there," said Fluke. "Don't reckon you'll ever accept it, though." Keel dug at the turf with the toe of his boot.
"She really wants me to stay this time."
"She wants that every time. Hasn't stopped you before."
"Things are different now. There's Tad."
Fluke grunted.
"He's my son," Keel said, as if by speaking the words aloud he was explaining something to himself.
"He is,"
Fluke agreed.
"So what are you going to do about that?"
Keel wished he had an answer, but every path forward seemed impossible. He couldn't stay and he couldn't go. He had to help Tad somehow, and he couldn't do that while scratching a living in Rackham Bay. Yet if he left to seek a solution, he'd lose Mariella. Hard as it was to be with her, it would be harder without. He needed to know he was loved, even if it came from afar. She was his anchor to the world while he went roaming. Without her, the black pit inside would surely consume him.
"Do you reckon she meant it? About leaving me?"
He resented having to ask, but his brother knew her better than he did these days.
"She meant it," said Fluke. "Whether she could do it, that's another question."
They stood there for a time, contemplating the farm below.
"Didn't you ever want to get away from this town?"
Keel asked.
"No," said Fluke. "I have all I need right here." "Dar always dreamed we'd stay on the boat, working together after he died."
He waved a hand at the scene below.
He'd have hated all this.
The old bastard hated a lot of things. I hated the sea, but that didn't count for naught with him. I had to be a whaler all the same. Now my farm feeds your family.
I know it, said Keel, then forced himself to add, I'm grateful.
Don't be. I don't do it for you.
Fluke showed no sign of moving. Keel realized he was building up to something.
Say your piece, Fluke. You brought me out here for a reason, and I reckon it wasn't to admire your farm.
Right you are, said Fluke, casting him a sour glance from beneath his dark fringe.
He sniffed.
I reckon you ought to go.
Keel raised his eyebrows. He'd been expecting the usual lecture on responsibility.
Go, and don't come back, Fluke said. Ever.
Keel gave a bitter laugh of surprise.
If you want to tell me how you feel, I'll settle for a brotherly embrace, he said sarcastically.
Fluke ignored that, as he did all humour.
You're killing her, Keel.
Keel sobered at that. The tone of his voice, the way he said it, it didn't sound like an exaggeration.
Every time you go, you leave her waiting, Fluke went on. That's her life. She gets through the day, and she waits. For you.
His voice went dark with anger.
Then back you come for a day, a week, just long enough that she thinks you might stay this time. But you don't. You never will. And each time you break her bloody heart a bit worse than before.
She knew my nature when she married me, said Keel.
Angry resentment swelled beneath his words.
She's the fool if she thought she could change me.
She's the fool, Fluke agreed. And she's paid for it, and paid again. She thought a child might keep you by her side, and that was foolishness too.
He balled up a fist, rubbed the side of his neck with his knuckles, the way he did when he was tense.
You need to let her go, Keel. She's trapped, and she always will be while she's hoping you'll come back. Tell her you're not, and don't.
Keel had to fight down the urge to strike him.
You've got a lot to say about my family these days, brother. Any advice about my dying son?
Speaking the words almost pushed him over the edge into tears.
Tad's in the hands of the Aspects now, said Fluke,
rolling on with his argument, his opinions slow and heavy as stone.
Best your druidess friend can do is stave off the inevitable.
You'll never get the money to cure him, and you know it.
And what will you do when I'm gone? Keel sneered. You'll look after them in my stead, then?
In your stead? I've been looking after them for 4 years already, accepting a few donations when the mood strikes you. Can't see that changing any time soon.
That was too much to bear. Keel seized him by the coat, pulled his brother around to face him, so furious he couldn't speak. Fluke gazed at him, unafraid, possessed of that same dull determination with which he ploughed through the seasons.
You're bad for her, Fluke told him. Do what's right, and go.
The only choice then was between driving a fist into Fluke's impassive bovine face, or flinging him away. Keel shoved him hard before the temptation to punch overwhelmed him. Fluke staggered a few steps down the trail, righted himself, and looked back at Keel, unruffled.
She doesn't love you, Keel flung at him. She'll never love you, no matter how many times you pick up the pieces. She doesn't love you, Fluke. She's mine.
He saw the flicker in his brother's eyes as his word struck home, and took vicious satisfaction in it.
Where's your sanctimony now? Where's your superiority? Where's your advice?
Fluke dropped his gaze, then looked off across the hills to where the black clouds were heaping.
The rest of your lot are nearby?
We made camp in the woods, said Keel.
Their confrontation was over as suddenly as that. They both sounded weary and deflated.
Tell them to come for dinner, said Fluke, jacking a thumb towards the farm. They can stay in the barn.
You sure?
This is still Ossia, last I looked, said Fluke.
Still Ossia, where strangers were offered hospitality, where a table was for sharing, and generosity was the measure of a man. There was no bitterness about it, even after their angry words. Fluke never could hold a grudge.
"I'll tell them," Keel said.
Fluke hooked his thumbs in his trousers and squinted at the sky.
"Make it quick. Storm's coming," he said, and walked away down the track.
59. Thunder snarled, and a curtain of rain came out of the night. The woods, dark and quiet a moment ago, turned riotous as the secret rustle of animals was drowned out by the hiss and splatter of the storm. Leaves bowed and nodded. Trails turned to muddy pools. A family of boars ran snorting for shelter. Vika hurried through the doorway of the derelict cottage, carrying a dead rabbit by the ears. Ruck had gone ahead, not minded to wait for her slower companion, and was shaking herself off in the gloom. Inside, it was dank with rot and mould, and the rain dribbled through the roof in half a dozen places, making puddles among the decayed rushes strewn across the floor. There was a crude table, a few stools, a bed with a hand-stitched mattress. A tin plate and mug lay on the floor near the table. A mean and meagre dwelling then, but it was drier than outside, and Vika thanked the aspects for that. She dropped the rabbit on the floor and raised a warning finger at Ruck as the hound came over to investigate. Then she took off her hide cloak, which had saved her from the worst of the deluge, and wrung out her hair where it had got loose from her hood. She poked around the cottage a little. It didn't take long. There was a pantry, a tiny area for storage, and the main room. Given the state of the place and the way it had been left, she guessed that the owner had intended to return, and never did. Likely they were killed by something in the forest, a wild animal or perhaps a fatal fall. She said a prayer to the red-eyed child for the previous owner, and then set about smashing up furniture for the fireplace. She'd left the others back in Fluke's barn. Keel's brother hadn't been a particularly sociable or talkative host, but he was willing to extend the hand of friendship to strangers, and to give generously of what little he had. Vika respected him for that. It heartened her to know that the old ways hadn't been entirely forgotten under the Croden yoke. Keel hadn't dined with them, but gone back to his cottage. He had bridges to repair, and wanted to spend what time he could with his family. The ship to Morganholm was leaving at dawn on the morrow, and he'd yet to decide if he would stay or go. The uncertainty was hard on Garrick, who feared to lose his oldest friend, but he kept his silence on the matter. When she had a decent pile of stool legs, planks, and wool in the hearth, she sprinkled it with fire dust and dug through her wet cloak till she found the file she needed. She dripped its contents onto the fire dust, and it began to fizz and sparkle, burning furious white, spreading outwards until the whole hearth was filled with blinding glare. Gradually it faded, white to yellow and orange, leaving fire licking and crackling the wood.
"I know, I know," she said to Ruck. "Wasteful, but it's so much easier than flint and tinder."
If Ruck disapproved, it wasn't enough to stop her enjoying the flames. She slunk closer to warm herself. Vika gave her a rough pat and got to her feet.
"Now then, let's set to it."
She hung her cloak to dry by the fire and pulled out some cooking implements from her sodden pack. Then she found her foraging bag and counted her gains from the night. Herbs, mushrooms, roots and flowers. Most had been readily given by the forest, but the catfoot briar had proved troublesome to find, and it had delayed her long enough for the storm to catch up. She'd hoped to be back in the barn before it broke, but she had no choice but to persevere. She needed to make Tad's potion tonight. The fire held off the night and warmed the dank corners of the cottage, while the storm boomed and rolled outside. Vika and Ruck dried as she worked, peeling twigs with her knife, baking leaves till they were crisp, chewing roots to pulp and spitting them out again. She collected rainwater through the leaking roof, filling two pots, one small, the other smaller. These she set to boil, and when they were bubbling, she began to throw the ingredients in. The air filled with earthy scents. Ruck, recognizing the process, laid her head on her paws and watched with anticipation. When the basics of both concoctions were in place, she took up the dead rabbit, cut off its head, and drained its blood into the smallest pot, saying a prayer of thanks as she did so. She tossed the carcass to Ruck, who fell on it eagerly, her patience rewarded at last. While the wolfhound crunched and chewed beside her, Vika drew a shallow cut on her forearm and added a few drops of her own blood to the mix. That done, she set the smallest pot aside to cool. Rabbit blood was weak sauce for the brew, but her own contribution would add potency. Blood was the power, blood the fuel, blood the catalyst. It was said that the blood of elder druids, steeped in the essence of the Shadowlands and distilled through a lifetime of potion-taking, could make concoctions more powerful than Vika could dream of. An elder druid might have been able to cure Tad's condition rather than merely delaying its progress, but Vika didn't have craft enough for that. There were other ways to increase the potency of a potion, of course. Ways she could outstrip even the elders, were she tempted to take them. But those were forbidden paths, and not for her. She drank from the bloodied pot, and let the brew seep into her. Tendrils of acid heat spread from her belly to her groin, up her neck, wrapping round her skull. Her mind opened outwards, an unfurling flower of consciousness, and her senses sharpened till she could hear the tick of insects in the boles of the trees, and smell the spoor of mice and deer, wildcat and fox. Air sighed in and out of her, drawn into her lungs and expelled back into the world, altered. She was no longer a separate thing, one and alone, but a part of her surroundings, a channel through which the flow of existence moved, out of the past and into the future. She closed her eyes and saw Agali Sings the Dark, her friend and mentor, sitting by the light of another fire, as Vika complained of being abandoned by the gods. It had sounded churlish then, and more so now. Her last doubts had been swept away at the entrance to Skavengard, as she held the gates against the Dreadnights with sacred light. What else could that have been but the aspects working through her? Her task had been set by the gods themselves, to walk at Garrick's side and protect him from the servants of the Void, for that was surely what the Dreadnights were. She'd sensed its taint on them, and they'd been kept out of Skavengard by the same sorcery that kept the beast in. But how did it all connect? What did Garrick's plan to steal the Ember Blade have to do with the hellish future the Torments had revealed? Why were the Crodans consorting with Dreadnights, and whatever dark force lay behind them? Time would tell. Until then she had work to do. Her trance had deepened enough that she was everywhere and nowhere, hyper-aware of her surroundings and no longer aware of herself. She sensed the borders of the Shadowlands on the fringes of her consciousness, and made a channel to it, in the same instinctive way as she might move her fingers or clench a muscle. She willed it, and it was so. She siphoned off a mote of chaos, a firefly glimmer, a spark, and sent it into the bubbling pot on the hearth before her. In that moment, the contents of the pot were no longer rainwater and herbs, but something else, a tumble of possibilities, all existing at once, waiting for her to choose one. Given more power, more chaos, it could become blood, or oil, or wine. But the bigger the channel she opened to the Shadowlands, the more likely something unwelcome would find its way through. All she needed was to make a small adjustment to the essence of the concoction, turning it into something potent, imbuing it with the power to bring change of its own. Quick as a blink, it was done. The mote of chaos winked out. Randomness became order, and there was a new reality inside the pot. She drew her mind back from the Shadowlands and relaxed. Moving as if in a dream,
She picked up a rag and used it to take the pot off the heat. Then she let herself rest and stared into the fire while her mind roamed in strange places and molten ribbons writhed like worms across her vision. Sometime later, she stirred, aware of herself again. She took the pot and poured its contents into a boiled leather flask, which she sealed with pitch and put in her pack. It was still raining, and the lightning-lit woods hissed and seethed. The puddles on the floor had spread and were creeping towards where Ruck dozed. She put her cloak on again, now dry and warm from the heat of the fire. The assault came without warning, an ambush from her subconscious that staggered her with its force. Her eyes went dark and her mind was plunged into greasy blackness. Something cold, cloying and rancid was against her skin, pressing at her face, forcing itself down her throat. She flailed against the slithering movement, choking on foulness. The beast! The blackness around her became a yawning maw, stuffed with concentric rows of teeth, a slimy gullet into the abyss. Vika screamed and found herself on her hands and knees on the floor of the cottage, retching, Ruck barking frantically at her. She gasped, disorientated, the taste of it still in her mouth. "Peace, Ruck," she said, reaching for the water skin from her pack. She took a swig, spat it out, and drank the next. "Peace!" She felt anything but peaceful. Swimming through the beast's alien thoughts had sent her dangerously close to madness. It had taken her days to heal her bruised psyche and take control again, but still the remnants lingered. Maybe she'd purge herself in time, maybe she never would. That was the price of dealing with servants of the outsiders. She feared more for Kiel than herself. She had plenty of experience with madness and knew how to handle it. Kiel didn't, and he'd stared into the eye of that foul thing. She feared he'd carry the scars forever. Something passed by the doorway in the rainy dark outside, and she whirled, all senses alert. The potion in her blood had faded somewhat, but her hearing was still keen as a fox's. She'd heard nothing, but she'd seen. Or had she? Nine, it was so hard to know. So hard to pick out what was real and what was a trick of the brain. Ruck had no such doubts. She was stanced, ready for attack, snarling at the doorway. Lightning flickered, showing waving branches and thrashing bushes. Thunder barreled away into the distance. There was a familiar sense of otherness in the air, the taint of the Shadowlands. A slow dread soaked into her. What did I bring through? She swept up her pack and staff. This place felt suddenly dangerous. No shelter, but a trap. If there were enemies abroad, they could see in, but she couldn't see out. A dark figure slid past the window behind her. She half saw, half sensed it, but by the time she turned, it was gone. Ruck barked furiously at the spot where it had been. "We will not cower in here," she said to her hound. "Let us see who has come calling." She pulled up her hood and stepped out into the storm. The rain blew against her face, and her cloak flapped about her. Keen-eyed, she scanned the trees. The woods were bright to her under the influence of the potion, the colour of steel and silver. "Show yourself," she cried. Ruck padded up alongside her, grey fur plastered to her lean body, and her bearded muzzle dripping. "Show yourself, Shade." There was no response. Vika walked into the trees, wary for signs of movement. Anger made her brave. If this was a shade, she'd know its purpose. She was anointed of the aspects. She'd faced down the beast of Skavengard. She didn't fear the pale tricks of ghosts. That, at least, was what she told herself. Agali would have counseled caution. Of late, the spirits had become unpredictable, harder to treat with, while reaching the Shadowlands had become easier by the year. Neither change boded well. Some said the divide was narrowing, bringing the worlds of the living and the dead closer together. Soon
It wouldn't only be the wild and ancient places where the shades came creeping through. But that was still rumour as yet. It would take a conclave to determine the truth of it, if another conclave was ever called. Her senses strained. She could smell and hear nothing but the woods and the rain. Only her prickling instincts and the buzz in her head told her there was something else present. "Show yourself!" she cried again, and this time it did. It slid out sideways from behind a tree, and Vika's breath froze in her chest. The torment towered over her, terrifyingly close, its eyes empty pits ringed with tendrils of gangrene, its mouth a toothless puckered O in a white shriveled face. The sides of its throat had been slit lengthways, the skin held open in wet red diamonds by a structure of hair-thin metal, exposing the glistening muscle and twitching arteries beneath. Ruck flattened herself to the ground, whining like a cur. Vika was paralysed, locked in place as she stared into the void of its eyes, which swelled in her vision as if she was tipping into them. A hulking man, clad in black metal, hammer in hand, riding a destrier through the rain. A ragged scarecrow with a longbow, his face a jigsaw of other people's skin, beetles and worms swarming from his footprints in the turf. A hooded shadow, with a metal mask twisted in a grieving howl, hunched in his saddle, the glitter of swords like fangs beneath his cloak. And she was cast back into herself, blinking and shaking. The torment was gone, if it had been there at all. The storm growled and flashed. The rain drove down from the sky, but the night was only the night again. Ruck whined deep in her throat as Vika realized what she'd seen. The Dreadknights, riding through a wood. This wood. And suddenly she understood the warning as clear as if it had been spoken aloud. "They're here," she said aghast. Then, breaking into a run, "They're heading for the farm." 60. Clisson hunkered in his saddle and looked down the hill at Fluke's farm. The rain pounded out of the night, splattering off his wide-brimmed hat and the black overcoat that enshrouded him, and a distant flicker of lightning lit up his spectacles, two white circles in the shadow. "By the Primus, if I get through tonight without a chill, it'll be a miracle indeed." "All's quiet," said Hart, who sat astride a roan mare at his side, sheltered by an identical hat. The redundancy of his comment irked Clisson. It wouldn't be much of an ambush if it wasn't. Hart said nothing to that, just mopped his running nose with a handkerchief. His overcoat, like Clisson's, was entirely ineffective against the downpour. He, too, was pretending to suffer no discomfort. "All of us desperately keeping up appearances. How did we ever get like this? We're the greatest power in Embria, and yet we're all scared of not measuring up to the next man in case our peers think less of us." Sometimes he wondered if the Ossians had it right after all. They didn't spend their days fretting about how they might seem more loyal and efficient, or sizing up their rivals' backs for the best place to stick a knife. "I always had my suspicions about that man Lane. Garrick, you say he goes by now." It was Lord Jadrell who'd spoken, a short, pudgy man with a piping nasal voice and a pencil-thin tracing of facial hair to furnish the illusion of a jawline.
"Given to seditious talk when drunk, as I recall."
"Then you should have reported him when you had the chance," said Clisson. Jadrell panicked and began to bluster.
"Would that I had been able to, Overwatchman, but the knowledge only reached my ears after he had left Rackon Bay, and Keel, nobody expected such treasons from Yarn's boy. He was Whalerstock through and through."
Clisson let silence be his reply. He'd despised Lord Jadrell on sight, and their brief acquaintance had only confirmed his opinion. There was nothing more embarrassing than an Ossian aping his betters.
He talked enthusiastically about artists and composers he'd just discovered when most Crodans had long since tired of them, and made laboured references to fashions already 10 years out of date. And the things he did to the Crodan tongue. The language of Thomas and Toven wasn't meant for Ossians, who rolled their R's like purring cats and threw their words together in a jumble. But for all Jadril's failings, it was Clisson's job to suffer him. The Emperor had decreed that Ossian highborns should be encouraged to assimilate. They should be dazzled with Crodan learning and Crodan culture, steeped in the superiority of their new masters so that they'd aspire to be like them, and their children too. Conquer them with peace, make them want to be ruled. The Emperor had learned in Brunland that brute force and bloody repression were not the most effective ways to subdue a country.
"The men are almost in place, Overwatchman Clisson," said Captain Dressel.
Stealthy figures, barely visible, moved through the muddy fields surrounding the farm. They went in threes, with disciplined efficiency. The fugitives had a master swordsman among them, but they wouldn't find the Iron Guard such easy prey as the road patrol they'd slaughtered.
"It is fortunate indeed that I could be of service," Jadril said, with forced jauntiness.
The presence of the Iron Hand in his town had made him nervous.
"If I hadn't instructed my men to keep a close watch, he might never have seen the cart arrive."
"If our man is inside, you will have done a great service to the Empire," Clisson assured him dryly. "And you'll be rewarded, that's what you're really asking, isn't it?"
"Then let us hope he is," said Jadril, "for nothing would please me more."
"Yes, let us hope he is." And how dearly Clisson looked forward to catching him, so that he could go back to Morgenholm and Vanya, and his golden-haired daughters and his silly old cat. It would be a relief to surround himself with people he loved instead of those he loathed. He was so tired of sycophants and backstabbers, wearied by the endless suspicion. Dressel was the only man in his present circle he didn't actively dislike.
"May I ask why this man is of such interest to the Iron Hand?"
Jadril inquired. "Because my promotion depends upon him. Because I swore to Chancellor Draxis that I would bring him in. Because I'll be ruined and humiliated if I don't."
"The Iron Hand's business is its own," said Hart sternly, and Jadril shut up.
Clisson was vaguely annoyed that his subordinate had answered in his stead, but he had bigger matters on his mind right now. "Garrick, Lane of Heath Edge, whatever name you go by, I know who you really are, Cadrach of Darkwater, and soon you will know my name too."
He raised a gloved hand. There was a creaking of harness from behind them, and the Dreadknights moved into view on his right, sitting astride their enormous black destriers. They halted in a line, waiting for his order. Having them so close made his skin creep. His face and chest began to itch, as if there were tiny insects crawling all over him, and his horse pranced and sidestepped uneasily. Yet still he didn't drop his hand. Still he held them back. Let them know, whatever they were, that they were servants of the Empire first and foremost. His servants, for as long as they were assigned to him. He trusted them less than he trusted Hart, and that was saying something. At least Hart was loyal to Croda, if not to Clisson. How could he say the same of the Dreadknights, when he didn't know who they were or where they came from? The moment stretched out. Plague turned his dead-flesh mask to Clisson, making a low, quiet clicking sound, a rattle like bones in his throat. "Go," said Clisson, and he dropped his hand. They went like dogs after hares, racing downhill towards the farm. Hart looked from Clisson to the Dreadknights, and back again, waiting for a signal of his own, but Clisson gave him none. He was staying right here. Only fools put themselves in the way of swords. He saw realization dawn on Hart's face.
they wouldn't be following the Dreadnoughts into battle. The younger man struggled with the concept of obedience for a moment, then his expression hardened. He unsheathed his blade, wheeled his horse, and plunged down the hill with a cry. Clisson bit back the urge to swear. Now Clisson had to follow, or look like a coward in front of Dressel and the Ossian prig by his side. With a reluctant kick to his horse's flanks, he went riding into the folly. So did Jadril and Dressel, all driven onwards by the fear that they'd be deemed less loyal to the Empire than their brave and stupid fellow. "Falcons to ducklings, what have we become?" Down the slope they went, their horses' hooves churning up the dirt. Clisson jounced and swung in his saddle, holding on for his life. Lightning flashed, showing Hart hunched over his horse up ahead. He was an expert rider, of course, trained in the saddle from a young age. Just one more advantage to add to all the others his appearance and upbringing afforded. The animals went berserk as the Dreadnoughts rode past the outbuildings. Pigs squealed and goats screamed, clamouring in their pens. It would give those within the barn some warning, but not much. It didn't matter anyway. If they fled, they'd be met by the iron guard hidden among the hedgerows. Ruin dragged his horse to a halt and dismounted as he reached the barn, landing on his feet with a crash of metal. Plague and sorrow slid down to either side of him as Ruin hefted his hammer, swung it in a giant arc, and smashed the barn doors open with one blow. His nimbler companions darted inside, and Ruin stamped after them. Hart reached the flat ground between the outbuildings and charged onwards. Clisson followed, his stomach rolling, with Dressel keeping pace to his right and Lord Jadril whooping and squeaking behind him in polite distress. As they approached the barn, Hart began to slow, his sword lowering uncertainly, and by the time Clisson saw the towering figure of Ruin emerging from the barn unbloodied, he knew what had happened.
"They're not there!" Hart cried as they came to a stop next to him.
Clisson was surprised to hear anger in his voice. The watchman turned an accusing gaze to Jadril.
"Where are they?"
Jadril's eyes were wide, shocked and fearful as a child's.
"But Endric saw them going into the barn. They dined here."
"Their cart is here, but they are not."
Clisson, sweaty and sodden and short of breath, willed ice into his veins. It was time for clear thinking and command.
"Leave a perimeter and search the outbuildings," he told Dressel.
He pointed at the Dreadnoughts, who'd all emerged from the barn.
"You three, search the farmhouse."
"Every third man to me," Dressel roared over the wind. "The rest, hold fast."
His order was repeated in the distance, echoing out for the benefit of those who hadn't heard it. The Dreadnoughts stalked into the farmhouse as soldiers of the Iron Guard melted out of the dark, gathering round Dressel. He led them towards the stable, leaving Clisson alone with Hart and Jadril. Clisson looked inside the barn. Bitter anger gathered in his belly. Their bedrolls had been left behind, as had their gaudy, sard cart and the horses that pulled it. He'd bet that if he peered inside that cart, he'd find it full of possessions. Yet their weapons and packs were gone. The fugitives had left in a hurry, taking only the minimum with them.
"Somebody warned them," Clisson said. "Does it please you, Ossian, to see the Iron Hand embarrassed?" Hart demanded of Jadril.
Jadril gaped like a fish, searching for any reply that wouldn't be considered impertinent.
I acted in good faith."
"Yes, your kind always has an excuse, don't you? And yet you always manage to fall just short of being actually helpful. What do they call it now? Passive resistance?"
"I am a loyal servant of the Emperor," Jadril protested.
"Yes, this country is full of loyal servants like you—"
"Watchman Hart," Clisson snapped. "Control yourself. You are an officer of the Iron Hand."
Hart glared at him hotly, then swept away towards the farmhouse, stung. Clisson watched him, outwardly calm, inwardly calculating. Commander Gosson's dearest wish was to see Clisson fail in his mission to catch Garrick, so he could install his lapdog Betron as his replacement. But Hart was furious that Garrick wasn't here. That didn't square with Clisson's suspicions that he was spying for Gosson. Clisson had assumed his general negativity about their mission was Hart being purposefully obstructive, but it was possible he'd been overly paranoid. Maybe Hart was just bored when he was idle. After all, he'd been enthusiastic enough when he killed the prisoner at Shoal Point. Too enthusiastic, in fact. Interesting.
"My information was good and given gladly," Jadrell mewed. "I swear by the Primus."
Clisson, whose back was to Jadrell, rolled his eyes. "And so it's left to me to smooth the ruffled feathers." He turned and gave him an unctuous smile. "Of course, Lord Jadrell. It's through the efforts of men like yourself that the will of the Emperor is done. Forgive my subordinate. He's just excessively disappointed he didn't get to serve the Empire tonight."
"Well, I'm glad you understand, Overwatchman."
"Clisson!" Hart called from the farmhouse.
Clisson clenched his teeth. How long before that insufferable bastard learned to address him by his title? He stored the insult away, adding it to the long list of grievances Hart would pay for when Clisson was commander of Ossia. Hart was dragging a man dressed in long johns and a rough-spun bedshirt out of the farmhouse. Plague walked at his shoulder. The other two dreadnoughts headed off towards the other outbuildings. By the time the man was pushed to his knees in front of Clisson, his clothes were soaked through, and his dark brown hair hung in sodden curls over his eyes. Clisson peered down at him from beneath the dripping brim of his hat.
"You own this farm?"
Fluke glanced at the open door of the barn, then back at Clisson. He had the sullen and defiant look of a bitter bracker, but there was fear in his eyes all the same.
"I do."
"Where did they go?"
Clisson asked. "I don't know," said Fluke.
Clisson gave Plague a tiny nod, a silent instruction. "Where do you think they've gone?" he asked.
"I don't know,"
he said again. But this time he tailed off uncertainly as his attention was caught by something else. He raised a trembling hand in front of his face, stared at it in growing horror.
"Guess," said Clisson.
Fluke pulled down the collar of his bedshirt and gazed uncomprehendingly at his chest with a low moan of fear. Lord Jadrell shifted uneasily, bewildered, but Clisson merely waited and watched. He'd seen Plague at work many times. The disease and corruption spreading throughout Fluke's body were entirely in his mind, invisible to the others, but it was no less effective a torture for that. Right now he was watching his skin flake, crack and blister at an impossible rate. Usually Clisson preferred the elegant art of interrogation, but he didn't have time to be subtle now.
"Joha!" Fluke cried out. "What's happening?"
"Joha's not here," said Clisson. "He's a figment of your imagination, like all your barbarian gods. But I'm here, and I can make it